This is Bob Kerr welcoming you to a Christmas holiday edition of The Record Collector, and we're going to have what our producer, Bill Terry, calls a real jamboree during this program, because with me, unusually, I have three guests, and in fact, I myself will be a guest also, so we have four people who are all mad record collectors, and we'll be presenting a couple of their own choices. Now, our guests today are all regulars in the program, Tom Hood, Bob Pye from Kelowna, and Ed Crommelin. And we're just going to go round and round and round till the program's over. Is that right? And I think the first one will be Tom Hood. And you'll have a lot to say about this one. You'd better, Tom.
Well, it's one of, I guess what you could call one of the rarest records in the world. It's a copy of a 5-inch cylinder made by an Italian back in 1900, a fellow by the name of Bettini. None of his recordings have ever turned up, other than about, possibly 30 or 40 of them, all in very poor condition, with the exception of this one. This one was found in New Zealand a few years ago and is the first good copy of one that's ever been found.
And it was transferred to 45.
Yes, I just secured a copy from the States a few months ago. It's the first, or the earliest recording of Marcellus Embry.
And whose voice did we hear?
Well, that was Mr. Bettini himself introducing it, and if you listen very carefully at the close of the recording, you'll hear his reaction to the recording. He says, "Brava, brava," right on the disc.
Let's hear it now.
Voce di primavera, scratti per Madame Sembri.
Marcellus Sembrich singing the voices, what was the Voices of Spring?
Voices of Spring, that's right.
Anybody, any comments to make about that real collector's item?
As a record collector, I think it's terrific.
Yes, maybe as a plain, ordinary listener, you might not think it's terrific, though.
No, because I tried to compare it with Mapleson's cylinders, and by golly, this is quite an improvement over his.
Oh, it's considerably better.
Yeah.
How about you, Bob?
Well, you know, just the fact that the thing exists is something to be happy about, because an example of a man's total technical art, particularly, and it may sound facetious to say technical art, but it was when the record was made. It's nice to
Beautifully made recording for the time.
Oh, it's in lovely condition,
yes.
Too. I can understand, I was thinking as I was listening to this, of stories you read about these prima donna in the real era of prima donnas going to the recording studios and making these records and then going back to listen to the test pressings and heaving them across the room and stomping out in fits of rage. You can easily understand why they did it, too.
Well, yeah, on that one. Hello. It's Sembrich, because I've never heard her before.
It has qualities. I'm only familiar with the Victor records by her, and there are certain vocal qualities that you can get from it that I don't believe the Victor records have to the same extent.
Mm.
I don't think it has.
Her voice doesn't seem to hoot so much on the high notes like she does.
I think Victor made a specialty of hooty sopranos. They seem to have every good one under contract.
Well, we're going to move to you now, Bob Pye, and see what you have to offer us.
Well, I'll tell you, it's not as old as Tom's.
Couldn't be much.
I feel like a Philistine. I'm practically in the LP era because my first record is from 1932. And I was so happy to get this because it's something that I think probably every collector of personalities wants, and it's something that I had no great thoughts of ever being able to get. Mildred Bailey, as you know, I'm practically a one-man Mildred Bailey cult, and I've played her record several times on this program. And
you can count me in, though. It's two men now.
Great. I think she's just marvelous, and this is her very first recording of Rockin' Chair. This is made for Victor in 1932.
Let me get grabbing at the flies round this rocking chair. My dear old Aunt Harriet, in heaven she be. Send me sweet chariot, for the end of these troubles I'll see. Old rocking chair, get this. Judgment Day is here, chained to my rocking ginseng, for I tan your hide. Can't get from this cabin, gone nowhere. Just sit me here grabbing at the flies round this rocking chair. My dear old Aunt Harriet, in heaven she be.
From 1932, Bob Pye's recording of Mildred Bailey singing Rockin' Chair, and she had a terrific influence on later pops and jazz singers, did she not, Bob?
Yes, Peggy Lee particularly, and I guess many of the others too. I don't think any good musician, especially from the 30s or 40s, could help but be influenced by listening to her records, which they certainly must have done in abundance.
Did you mention that her husband was there backing her up on xylophone?
No, I didn't. Oh. That's quite true. Mm. I think this is a group from the Whiteman Orchestra, isn't it, Ed?
That's right, yeah. Red Norvo.
Red Norvo was her husband.
Yeah, it was her husband.
Pretty. I have a record of Nellie Lutcher with him behind her.
Mm. He's quite a musician.
Do you have anything to say about Mildred Bailey, Tom Hood?
No, it's a little out of my field. Bob's the expert on that, and I'll leave it with him, although I enjoyed the recording.
I did very much, indeed. Mm. Well, I guess we have another guest, and that's me for a change.
Yes, now comes the revenge.
Well, I've given up collecting 78s quite a while ago, but I still have a fair collection of them, and as you people know, one of my favorite singers has always been Lucrezia Borri. And this is actually one of those ill-fated Camden LPs. Oh, I suppose you all have those.
Well, those ill-fated Camden LPs, if you have them now, they're worth about $25.
I know. Well, John Erling, you know, of the record shop in Seattle, told me that this particular one, which Bob Pye so happily gave me a little while ago,
you think I gave it to you,
is worth $45.
I can believe it.
This program is after Christmas, is not.
I'm just slow getting the bills out in December.
Oh, I see. Well, anyway, it's agony for all of us to pick our favorite items, but I'll just pick this because it represents the sort of tiny voice that Borri had. You agree it was a tiny voice?
No, I don't agree that it
was
a tiny voice.
Well, you know what I mean?
Fine spun.
Fine spun, but not tiny.
But it filled an opera house, and there was a lot of woman behind it. And if you think I'm being Freudian, so enjoy.
All right.
Anyway, it's the aria Connais-tu le pays, Knowest Thou the Land, from Mignon, and here is Lucrezia Borri. Lucrezia Borri singing Knowest Thou the Land from the opera Mignon by Thomas. How'd you like that?
Beautiful.
I'm going to dig it out and listen to it again when I get home.
Oh, you got it at home, have you? The original 78? Or?
No, I have the LP like you.
That would date from what year? 36?
I think it was 36, yes. This, I was thinking, the way I judge my favorite artist is the communication, which has to be a very personal thing. And I feel it's a very oblique thing. I couldn't explain it, but I feel the very same kind of communication with Borri in these records that I do with this, for instance, this Mildred Bailey record. They have a little extra something that just transcends singing the notes.
And we've often said on this program, I think, that the older singers seem to have more individuality of communication.
I was just thinking, by the way, listening to that recording, what a nice break that Borri got from the Victor Engineers.
Back in
1936, they were very unkind sometimes.
Well, some of hers are pretty bad because her voice is so intense. that it blasts on the record.
This was recorded in 1936?
Approximately, yes.
Very, very well recorded.
This would be just towards the end of her career when she retired in 36, didn't she?
Yes, the mid-30s anyway. Yeah.
Now we move on to Ed Crommelin. I guess we're going to get a pretty strong change of tempo here, are we not, Ed?
Yes, we may. With this excellent group of gentlemen for opera recordings, I thought I'll change the tune a little and bring in my old jazz for a change. And they are not as old as your records so far. I move right up to November 1940. And this is a recording by Eddie Condon's jazz band. Not a recording too well known, because this was for a little label, Commodore Music Shop, one of the first little independent companies, and long since died, gone broke and out of print. But what is important of this recording is that it's Dixieland in its very true sense. With that I mean, on the surface, a happy face, full of joy, but the true soul is still nostalgia and blues. That, to me, is real Dixieland. And some beautiful tailgate tromboning, which you may like, done by an old-timer, the man from New Orleans itself, George Prunes. All the men in this band of Eddie Condon are white, but for the pianist, Fats Waller.
Oh, my.
And anything Fats does, as far as I'm concerned, is always very musical. The man was a big clown, and I think too many people just looked at his clowning, and that's all they ever knew of him. But behind him was so much musical talent, and that comes out right here in this recording of You're Some Pretty Doll.
That was a marvelous record, Ed Crommelin, and Bob Pye's been sitting there saying amen for the last 3 minutes. How would you like to articulate what we all feel about that disc?
Oh, that is a beautiful record, and I've never heard it before. And it's so easy to say something dogmatic like this when no one's going to disagree, but we're really dealing in terms of genius with these people. And You know, it is too bad that everybody in the world can't appreciate this. When I like something, I always want everybody else to like it as much as I do. And
same with me. Yeah.
You just sort of shake people and say, "Listen to this, it's marvelous," and they just stand there and wait for you to stop shaking, and it's not very much fun sometimes. But,
Ed, will you just recapitulate what the disc was, please?
"You're Some Pretty Doll" by Eddie Conlon's Jazz Band, November 1940.
Fats Waller
would be violating his Victor contract by making this record, too.
No, he was just out of contract at the time. Yes. And George Bruni's on trombone, Eddie Conlon guitar, Artie Shapiro on bass, and George Wetling drums. All old Dixieland guys.
That was quite thoroughly back. The real thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sad to think that really this clown image that Fats Waller had, I think you're quite right in saying that he didn't mind being a clown, but I think he was pushed into it by the movie people and the radio people and the record people, because the clown image was a selling image, and the musician probably wasn't quite as commercially valuable to them.
Yeah, Coleman Hawkins once mentioned to me in this respect about Fats. I talked to him about it. He said, "Yeah, never forget it. Fats Waller is a man with a terrific fast mind, and on top of it, he is so full of pep and joy and wants to give a story and music out to everybody that's around, that he has to clown just to let steam off." And they let him do it because he did it so well, and it became part of an act almost. But that wasn't the real Fats. Fats, in his heart, was a musician through and through, and that is the real story that Fats should have given to the people.
I think people are only really beginning to discover this in the last two or three years.
No, yes, I think so too.
Well, now we move ahead, or back?
Way back, way back.
I hope not as far back as that Sembri record.
Oh, we're going to move up one year.
This is Tom Hood. Tom Hood again.
Very good.
Well, I played the Sembri recording, and I thought, well, I might as well stay in this particular era. So the next recording is Victor's first big seller, Harry McDonough and the Holy City. I mentioned this in a previous program. It's an interesting example because you'll notice the title is announced on the recording. At the beginning of the recording. This was a hangover from the cylinder days when they couldn't print the title on the stub end of the cylinder because it wasn't big enough, and it carried over onto flat lateral discs. Victor didn't do it for a very long time. They dropped it quite quickly. Columbia carried on for some time with these announcements.
How about Edison?
On
the Edison had
Edison cylinders had announcements
yes,
on
yes,
them,
yes,
but
yes.
Not as later
None of his Hillendales.
No. Not that I've heard. Maybe no. Bob's heard one or two.
No.
Not one, eh?
No.
Well, I don't think I want to play all of this because it's a pressing that is an example of a time. It looks like...
19-1.
It's suitable for the season.
Well, the surface of the disc looks like a side view of the Atlantic in midwinter, so we'll hear a small part of it anyway.
I don't want to get seasick.
The Holy City, sung by Harry McDonough. Last night I lay sleeping, there came a dream so fair. I stood in old Jerusalem, beside the temple there. I heard the children singing, and ever as they sang, lift up the voice of angels, from heaven in answer rang. Before the voice of angels, from heaven in answer rang. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, lift up your gates and sing. Hosanna in the highest, Hosanna to your King.
We've must cut that or we won't have any equipment left. Thanks for bringing that record down, Tom Hood. It's nice of you.
Well, I wanted to play it because it's referred to so often, and there's not too many copies of it around anymore, so if collectors are listening, they've at least now heard what it sounded like. Although I can't imagine anybody departing with anything to get that recording.
In his later high-fidelity recordings.
His later high-fidelity.
Harry McDonald sounds pretty good, yes.
Do you people all have him?
You can't escape him. He pops up quite often.
Well, I think that was utterly charming.
Did you bring your own steel needles to play this tonight?
Well, I think the engineer feels that way now after listening
his
to the way it played.
His face registered the most pain I've seen in long months.
Well, we had it on anyway.
I think it's most interesting and Christmassy. Now we move again to Robert Pye from Kelowna.
Well, Tom stepped up one year and I stepped back. 1931. And out of loyalty and out of a deep respect that I have for this artist, I brought along a Gene Austin record. I am on a lifelong crusade for unappreciated artists, and I really feel that Gene Austin has never had the credit he deserves.
You can sign me up on that one, Bob.
Good.
I am a Gene Austin.
You mean at what era? He did at the time.
Well, I don't think he ever was really appreciated in his time for what he had to offer, and certainly not by the Victor people who gave him some pretty ordinary material to work with, but,
He had a great following when he was coming on stage anywhere. I remember in England he came once, and my, they broke the house down.
Well, he certainly deserved this kind of appreciation. His records, surprisingly enough, in my opinion anyway, are at their best at the time when they weren't selling, and that's in the early 30s. Mm-hmm. And this is the only copy I've ever seen of this, and I'm very happy to have it. It's 1931, as I said, quite an obscure song called Now You're in My Arms.
People laugh, they call me a dreamer. I love you from afar. Let people laugh, I'll still be a dreamer. I'll follow my star. I'd always known that dreaming would guide me. I never hoped for more. But dreams have flown and you are beside me. True love is at my door. I saw you up in the moon. I held your hand when I touched a moonbeam. And now you're in my arms. I saw you deep in a rose. I heard your voice when the birds were singing. And now you're in my arms. Bliss like this is almost inconceivable. Speak to me and make sure it's believable. Can it be true? I kissed you once in my dreams. My heart cried, please let me never wake up. And now you're in my arms. I saw you up in the moon. I held your hand when I touched a moonbeam. And now you're in. I saw you deep in a rose. I heard your voice when the birds were singing. And now you're in my arms. In my dreams. never wake up, and now you're in my arms.
Bob Pye's recording of Gene Austin, and I think, Bob, that, of course, he's one of the great stylists of this century so far, and I think we all agree that it's a very special thing to hear Gene.
Well, I love Gene Austin's records, and that, I was thinking, I don't know whether you gentlemen noticed, but that is the standard sort of Victor number one ending that that record has in this terrible plotting accompaniment. But
you're wondering if it was Nat Shilkret.
They re-released quite a few of his recordings on the X label.
Mm-hmm. Of course, some of them have better accompaniment than this. Mm-hmm. Quite a number
those
of his
X things, weren't some of those made just during the 50s by him?
There was
a separate LP made of contemporary.
Yes. No, well, the X recordings were all
old.
The original ones. Fats Waller was
yes,
on one
he's
of those.
On several.
Yes, yeah. So that's where he comes into my collection.
Any of you got an X recording of Frank Crummett?
Do you want him doing?
Abdul-Lamir.
I think we could
arrange. You're liable to be
it.
Showered. Yes, one question I'd like to ask you people. Did Austin have any stylistic influence on later singers? There's nobody else that ever sounded like him, is there?
Nobody else could get away with it.
He didn't really have any imitators at the time, any close imitators. And, of course, the nice, easy singers like Gene Austin were killed by the crooners in the early 30s, and he was very effectively eliminated from the big record-selling scene because there was no choice. He just couldn't compete because he didn't sing like that. His era had passed.
It seems hard to believe now, listening to those same old recordings, that he couldn't make it. Well, just my opinion.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they reissued that X material. Was that Victor, wasn't it?
It was Victor, yeah.
And even some of the things he did in the 50s that he'd make a comeback. He's still going, isn't he?
Yes.
You think there would be a market for that?
It's hard to say. Mm. I don't suppose they'll take the chance.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you have another record to play, don't you?
My last. Mm-hmm. And for the Christmas season, the other side of this recording, which we will not play, has Silent Night on it.
So we'll think
if there's any print through, we may hear some of that. I don't know. But you've all heard the Kirk and Tulloch Junior Choir. Now, this is getting real late, 1945 or 6?
It's all right. It plays at 78.
But it is at 78, yes.
Yes.
And I always have great success with them on the air, and there was a very inept reissue of them on LP by Capitol. Do you remember? You've seen that record.
I didn't know. A reissue of
them. Oh, it's a very...
On Capitol.
It sounds all right, but the notes and everything about it is amateurish.
The good ones are all on Parlophone.
Yes, well, they're all taken from Parlophone
beautiful.
By Capitol. Mm. And but there are many, many of them which are not and won't be put onto LP, and this one is one of them, and it's one of my favorites because, you know, like so many records, some of you have already played today, as a sort of magic settles down on them, they become enchanted. And of course, with the fantastic diction of these kids, it's just something to remember.
Francis Wishart's soloist in
No, I've got them written down on a tiny piece of paper here. Joan Summers and Moira Anderson, just two members of the choir. And the accompaniment is by the boss of the choir, the late Reverend J.L. McPherson.
Yes.
And here is one of the most unforgettable performances of a hymn I have ever heard.
I would live ever in the light.
was
two,
delightful.
Like that?
Beautiful. What is the title of that?
Just As I Am, one of the famous hymns sung by these two little girls from the Kirkintilloch Junior Choir.
Beautiful.
Kirkintilloch being a suburb of Glasgow, yeah. And I don't know whether the choir is still in action or not. But at that time, at the end of the war, they produced some of the finest children's choral records made. And the diction.
Yes.
Wouldn't you wish that our own children could speak like that so that it could carry over into song? Yeah. That tremendous diction.
It's just self-discipline, and that's badly lacking
nowadays.
No,
they normally speak that way, I think, the Scottish, very strong consonants.
But that's discipline. Because nowadays, everything goes sloppy and easy, you know.
You can just see them, you know, with their little angelic faces standing in front of the microphone. I can imagine the way they look from the way they sound.
Well, we leave the Kirkintilloch Choir, which is my last contribution to this jamboree of the record collectors, and return to Ed Crommelin.
Thank you, Bob. After this beautiful hymn, it's a little difficult for me to jump into my next contribution in music, but for the title. The title fits into your lovely song, because the title of the next recording I'm going to play is The World is Waiting for the Sunrise.
Which happens to be a Canadian song. Did you know that?
I've heard that once. I forgot all about it. Thanks for reminding me of that. That's true. Now, this is recorded by Melvin Powell and his orchestra. Just to read off the accomplishments of Mel Powell, is just like a catalog of any pianist dreamboat. Very, very intelligent chap. He was only 14 when he graduated from high school, and he became a pupil of Willie the Lion Smith. And in 1940, he joined Muggsy Spanier's band, and in 1943, he was in the forces and went overseas with Glenn Miller. Then in 1954, he joined Benny Goodman, dropped out of jazz, started to study with Paul Hindemith composition, became a music teacher in Queen's College, and then won a Guggenheim Fellowship in composition in 1959, and is now a teacher in composition at the Yale School of Music, and that's all Mel Powell. A young man, beautiful pianist, and here he plays with a little pickup band. And rather interesting is that the clarinetist on this recording is called Shoeless John Jackson. And this Shoeless John Jackson is nobody else but Benny Goodman. When Benny was under contract, was absolutely not allowed to play for anything but Columbia. But he wanted to sit in with Mel Powell, so he said, "My name is Shoeless John Jackson." They said, "You're in." And here they go. So this up-tempo swing arrangement of this lovely Canadian tune, The World is Waiting for the Sunrise. Thank you.
That was Ernest Seitz wrote that song, was it not?
Oh, you've got me.
I'm sure. He used to give piano recitals on the network here.
It's a very old tune. Very, very old.
The World is Waiting for the Sunrise, and I think our last number that you brought us, Ed Crumlin, is quite a superb one. Mel Powell, and of course, Shoeless John Jackson.
He has potential if he just get a decent name.
Put his shoes on.
Namely, Benny Goodman.
You should really mention about that Commodore label, Ed.
Commodore label, yes.
They did a lot for jazz.
Oh, they did a lot. The man just went out because he was keen himself, you know. And he put these records on, and I know he lost a lot of money on it. And for a while, he didn't even care. He said, I'll carry on someday. People will realize what I've been doing. They did, but it was far too late when he went
over. He was the first one to print the whole band right on the label where you could see it.
Oh, yes. In fact, I've got one of his very first recordings. He had no money to get a decent label, so he scratched the title with a pen on the label.
Etched it on the
etched
label.
Etched it on.